welcome to the Everything ECU podcast. I'm your host, Carla Ward, and today let's talk about emotions. More specifically, how to regulate them and start supporting children in regulating those emotions. Before we can understand regulating emotions, we need to dive into emotional development in children, which refers to the gradual growth and maturing of emotional skills and understanding as children navigate through the different stages of childhood. This process involves the development of abilities, such as recognizing, expressing, and managing their emotions, as well as understanding and responding to the emotions of others. It's a vital aspect of a child's overall well-being and lays the foundation for their social interactions and resilience in the face of life's challenges. As early childhood educators, understanding and supporting children's emotional development is crucial in fostering a positive and nurturing learning environment. This journey is influenced by a combination of genetic, environmental, and experiential factors, and it's our role as educators to facilitate and enhance this emotional growth in the children we care for. Emotional milestones refer to the significant stages or markers in a person's emotional development and growth through their life. These milestones mark key achievements or changes in their emotional capabilities, awareness, and understanding. They can vary wildly from infancy to adulthood and can include things like developing emotional attachment to caregivers, recognizing facial expressions, and displaying basic emotions like joy, sadness, or frustration. Learning to regulate emotions, such as understanding simple social cues and beginning to express empathy. Developing friendships, which is understanding more complex emotions and learning problem-solving and conflict resolution skills. Then we have forming a stronger sense of identity, experiencing a wider range of emotions, and developing more complex relationships. And then achieving emotional independence, meaning managing stress effectively and maintaining healthy relationships. These milestones are general guidelines and can vary from person to person. They're essential for understanding emotional development and ensuring individuals have the necessary tools to navigate their feelings and interactions with others. I also can't talk about milestones without bringing up the pandemic, because I'm sure so many of you agree that children really got nailed with emotional development delays due to COVID. Especially think about it, if they were home with one person, they're not going to receive that range of facial expressions that they might be exposed to when being in childcare with their peers. So we definitely have to head into this episode remembering that the pandemic really stunted a lot of people's emotional development. So it's important to remember that we're starting where the child is at, not necessarily where they quote unquote should be. So children experience a whole bunch of emotions, happy, mad, sad, you name it. It's like a colorful painting of how they see the world. These feelings are not just random. They're a big deal for children's growth. As educators, it's not just about noticing their feelings. It's about making a safe space for those feelings. And when we listen and display that we get it, we're helping them learn how to handle their feelings better, especially those big emotions. When they trust that we are there to help them and that we are there to stick with them through, you know, those most difficult emotions, the skills that they learn in our care will stick around long after they outgrow our program. Now, emotional regulation refers to the ability to recognize, understand, and effectively manage one's emotions. It involves the processes and strategies individuals use to modulate their emotional experiences, reactions, and expressions in a way that promotes well-being, adaptive functioning, and healthy interactions with others. Now, understanding emotional regulation is key for us as educators because it profoundly shapes how young learners develop emotionally. It's like the foundation for their emotional well-being. When we grasp this concept, we can create classrooms where children feel comfortable expressing their feelings. This sets the stage for better learning and fewer disruptions. Plus, knowing about emotional regulation helps us teach children how to handle stress and get along with others. It also helps us spot if any child needs extra support early on so we can give them exactly what they need. And when we understand this, we can be great role models showing children how to handle emotions in a healthy way. It's really about nurturing their emotional resilience and helping them grow not just academically, but emotionally too. So to understand emotional regulation, we need to understand the neuroscience behind it and how our brains navigate and balance emotions, influencing our overall well-being. So fun fact about me, I am obsessed with why people do things, specifically what's happening in their brains and the brain science that causes them to behave in a specific way. I especially love to learn and understand this in children. It would be difficult to go too deep into this on a podcast without it being its own episode because you need visuals, but I'm going to chat just a bit about why, as educators, we need to think about children's brains and the brain development that's taking place when we're working with them. I actually found that it helped me become a lot more patient when facing difficult situations in my classroom. It also helped me navigate and support the child better in their emotional development. So the brain is the control center of everything we do in life. We cannot control other people's brains, and sometimes we can't control our own because it makes the decisions as to what we do. But when we understand the brain, it helps us approach learning differently, as well as how we perceive, understand, and support children's emotions and their development. When people think of the brain, most think of, you know, left and right hemisphere. But there is so much more to that. I promise not to geek out too much and bore you, but I do hope you find the brain as exciting as I do. The brain is divided into four main lobes, each responsible for specific functions. These lobes work together to coordinate various cognitive and sensory processes. So first we have the frontal lobe, which is located at the front of the brain, behind the forehead. And it's crucial for higher cognitive functions, including decision-making, problem-solving, planning, and judgment. It's also where the primary motor cortex is located, which is responsible for voluntary muscle movement, and it plays a role in regulating social behavior and personality. The parietal lobe, go with me on it, is located at the top and back part of the brain. It's in charge of sensory processing. The primary somatosensory cortex, located in the parietal lobe, receives and processes sensory information from the body, such as touch, pressure, temperature, and pain. It's also responsible for spatial awareness. The temporal lobe, which is located on the sides of the brain near the ear, has the main function of auditory processing and memory formation. The hippocampus, critical to the formation of new memories, is also located in the temporal lobe. The temporal lobe is where language processing develops. In the left temporal lobe, there are areas involved in language comprehension and recognition. The occipital lobe is at the back part of the brain, and one of its functions is visual processing. It's responsible for processing visual information received from the eyes. This lobe plays a key role in identifying and making sense of visual input. Each lobe has a specific function, but it's important to note that the brain operates as an integrated system, and often the functions work together. Additionally, the association areas found throughout the brain integrate the information from different sources and are critical for the higher cognitive functions. So if one part of the brain is not fully developed or is not in the process of developing at an appropriate rate, it's going to affect other parts of the brain. So understanding the roles of the different lobes helps in appreciating the complexity and specialization of the brain. So brain injuries or disorders that affect specific lobes can result in characteristic changes in behavior, cognition, sensory processing. Now, when we go even deeper into the brain, I promise understanding this is so important in emotional regulation. And there are three key players in emotions that are within the lobes themselves. So there is the amygdala, which involves the emotional processing, particularly in the generation of emotional responses, which includes fear and pleasure. So it's the thing that decides how they're going to react to a situation. It's involved in the initial detection and processing of emotional stimuli. So for example, when the amygdala perceives a threat, it can trigger the fight or flight response. Then we have the prefrontal cortex, especially the ventromedial prefrontal cortex and the dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex, which plays a role in regulating those emotions. And it's involved in assigning the emotional valence to stimuli. So these regions help modulate the activity of the amygdala, exerting a regulatory influence on emotional responses. Then we have the hippocampus. It is implicated in the regulation of emotions as well, particularly in the formation of memories associated with emotional experiences. It interacts with the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex to contextualize emotional events and modulate the emotional response accordingly. So I've had children walk into my classroom where they're already on edge because they're thinking about how they were feeling yesterday in response to a situation that happened between them and another child. And that's part of the memory. So it really is important to think about how everything in the brain works together. And there's so many reasons to understand this. And one is that understanding behavior, positive or negative, isn't always a conscious choice, but it is a form of the brain's communication. The nature of the behavior is complex and involves both voluntary and involuntary aspects. So behavior can be influenced by a combination of conscious choices, environmental factors, genetic predispositions, and neurological processes. So we really have to take into account that honestly, sometimes they don't have control over what's happening. And we need to recognize the distinction between voluntary and involuntary behavior and that it's not clear-cut. The brain is a highly integrated system. Without it, we cannot live. We don't live without our brain. And even seemingly voluntary actions may have underlying neural processes that occur automatically. And additionally, external factors such as social and environmental influences can impact behavior. So what I am trying to drive home is that some of us need to reframe how we view those behaviors. I am the first to admit that I have 100% muttered the words that a child is choosing not to listen, not to comply. They are choosing to fight with their friend. But when we look at it from a different lens and we put things in place to help them navigate those involuntary emotions and become more aware of them, we are able to support the brain development of emotional regulation. And I can honestly say, and I know that was a lot, especially about the brain, I can honestly say that I didn't truly understand the importance of learning about the brain until I worked at a school for children with brain injuries. I worked with children who had brain damage from accidents and or abuse, and most of them walked and talked like you and me, and you would never know that their brain was injured until an incident happened. And it honestly came down to which part of the brain had been injured that affected their response to something. So for some children, there were cognitive delays. For others, there was major impulse control challenges and high emotional reactions. Now, of course, there were some students who had physical delays because that part of their brain had been injured. So the way the brain controls everything in our bodies is absolutely fascinating. So as we move forward and talk about child development, emotional regulation and development, think of it all as developing the brain and that the behavior is the brain's way of communicating with you. Now, let's have a reality check for a second. Does it make your job easier dealing with extreme negative behaviors when you understand the brain? Not in the moment. If you've ever had a child destroy your classroom or threaten you, both of which has happened to me, knowing that that child is trying to communicate with me did not make my teaching life easier right then and there. However, it sent a very loud and clear message to me that the child's emotional regulation and that part of their brain was in desperate need of intervention and support. So here are 6 ways we can support healthy neural pathways in early childhood. First, let's think about our learning spaces. We can make them dynamic and engaging, filled with activities that involve movement, exploration, and hands-on experience. These sort of activities help children actively learn and build those important connections in the brain. Secondly, our interactions matter a lot. Positive relationships and responsive communication between us and the child promote a sense of safety and trust. This, in turn, supports the development of neural pathways tied to emotional regulation and social skills. Let's also focus on resilience. Helping children navigate challenges and learn from setbacks is key. Teaching them problem-solving skills and showing them that making mistakes is okay helps build those neural pathways associated with adaptability and coping. And speaking of emotions, our role in teaching emotional regulation is crucial. When we model and teach strategies to manage emotions, we're actually strengthening those pathways in the brain responsible for self-regulation. We can stimulate their minds as well. Activities that encourage storytelling, puzzles, and open-ended questions are fantastic to developing language, problem solving, and critical thinking skills. These activities really light up those neural pathways. And remember, every child is unique. Tailoring our support to their individual needs ensures we're helping those crucial neural pathways where they might need a bit more attention and guidance. And lastly, another great strategy is to team up with families. You can't do it alone. Working together ensures consistency in supporting healthy neural pathways at home and in the classroom, reinforcing the positive efforts we make collectively. You can send them this podcast to help them understand emotional regulation, or find a parenting podcast that you can send to parents to help them understand why emotional regulation is so important. If a child cannot self-regulate, they are not going to be able to do any of the academics that are ahead of them in life. Our work isn't just about teaching ABCs and 1-2-3s. It's about nurturing these amazing brains and laying the groundwork for lifelong learning, emotional well-being, and future success. And to do this, we have to also become emotion detectives. Observation is one of the key tools that we can use in the classroom to better understand a child's emotional development and where they need support to regulate those emotions. I want to be clear. Regulating emotions does not mean we are trying to create robotic compliant children. We absolutely want children to feel all the emotions, but we want and they need for their own mental and physical health to have control over those emotions and their emotional responses. So the first tool I always recommend is the ABCs of behavior. So observing the antecedent, the behavior, and the consequences of a child to understand them better. I would recommend heading over to episode 44, where I dive deeper into the ABCs of behavior. Once you've done some observations and used your ABCs, you'll start being able to recognize children's temperament levels. So there's no science behind this, at least I don't believe so, but there is a strategy that I use, and it is my own internal way of gauging where a child is at emotionally. What I do is think about a child's emotions on a scale of 1 to 10. So 1 to 3 is the child regulated. You're able to have a conversation with them, present them with something challenging, they're able to approach a difficult situation critically, and they're able to work through it. Zones 4 through 7 is your middle zone. This is where children's frustration starts to gain a little bit. You see them a little bit annoyed, they're dismissive, but you're still able to converse with them. So we'll go into this a bit more in a second, but this is the stage that we really want to use to teach and support emotional regulation. This is where the train is starting to come off the tracks, but we're not there yet. Zones 8 through 10 is dysregulated. Being emotionally dysregulated means a person feels emotions more intensely than they should, feels them for longer than they should, and feels them at inappropriate times or responds to them in extreme ways. That can look like being impulsive or overly intense emotional response, an inability to manage their behavior, avoiding a difficult emotion, or completely shutting down or having trouble making a decision. It is very difficult as an educator to have a conversation with a child and help them regulate when they are an 8, 9, or 10. In fact, I wouldn't even try to have a conversation. You are more likely to escalate the situation. Certainly, we want to be present and we want to support them by labeling the emotion and providing them a safe space to calm down, but we do need to protect ourselves and the children in our program from getting hurt as well. I used to teach a child that would bang his head against the floor violently when he was dysregulated. It was actually very scary. So what I did was I had pillows in various areas of the classroom so that when he was dysregulated, I could very quickly whip a pillow under his head to keep both of us safe. Because unfortunately, I learned the hard way that if I tried to use my hands to protect his head, I would get bitten. So that is where your observations really come into play, you know, reflecting and looking back at what's working, what's not working, and what does dysregulated look like for this child. Of course, we are always hoping that our students are at a 1, 2, or 3. But that is wishful thinking to think that every child will always be at a 1, 2, 3. You're setting yourself up for a very shocking workday. That being said, it is absolutely possible to have everyone hovering around a 3-4, even a 5. And you may have children that, you know, hit the 5, 6, 7 emotions, but like I said, that's where you're going to intervene to help them regulate and come back to a state of calm. It takes time and practice. Your observations are huge in this, and remembering that it is all about brain development. So as you continue to get to know your students, you'll learn more about what regulated versus dysregulated looks like for each of them. You'll start to recognize the 6 and 7 temperaments and support a child to help them express their emotions in a way that makes them feel heard and that helps them regulate and solve their problem. You'll be able to help that part of their brain develop further. It's also important to mention that this is not a scale that you would use in collaboration with a child. This is a tool of 1 through 10 that you as an educator will keep in your mind to help you monitor the emotions in your program. One reason is that developmentally, little ones don't have a strong enough understanding of numbers to be able to use this as a tool to regulate their emotions. When we as educators can recognize where a child is emotionally, we are then able to calmly approach them and help them identify their emotions, provide them with tools and language to express those emotions, and hopefully help them regulate their emotions. One tool I used was the Zones of Regulation. It is a program that I will link to in our show notes, and it was absolutely fantastic, and it talks about the 4 zones of regulation, and it helps immensely with helping children label their emotions when they are struggling to self-regulate. Other tools that I used were having a calm down corner in our book nook with a variety of what I refer to as calm down toys. There were bottles with glitter, squishy balls, pillows if they needed to squeeze something. If you're able, another great tool to include is headphones and a tape deck. And I just realized how old I am because some of you may not even know what a tape deck is, but essentially something where a child can plug headphones in and listen to calming music in order to regulate their nervous system. And eventually, if we as educators keep observing and intervening and supporting when a child is at that 5, 6, 7 zone, it'll help them identify those feelings. And what's incredible, if we are consistent in our support, they will eventually be able to identify their feelings independently and remove themselves from the situation before it escalates so that they can self-regulate. This is not a quick fix. You are playing a long game when you are working with children on their emotional development. But the result is incredible and absolutely life-changing. I really hope that you found today's episode helpful. I hope that you found the brain as interesting and intriguing as I did. I certainly found that when I started thinking about children's development with the brain at the forefront of my mind, I guess at the forefront of my brain, I was a much stronger and more understanding educator, and I was able to intervene and support the students who struggle with emotional regulation a lot more. If you can, please follow and rate the Everything ECU podcast on the platform you're listening from, and happy educating.